Pull up a chair for this one. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hanger on Radio Hanger. And I've got a story today that most people get wrong because most people only remember who won the race. They forget the two men who nearly died trying to get there first. May 19, 1919. 107 years ago today, a little Sopwith biplane was somewhere over the North Atlantic, with a failing engine, a clogged water circulation system, and two men who knew they were not going to make it to Ireland. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now let's go back to the spring of 1919. The Great War had just ended. Aviation had gone from a carnival novelty to a weapon of industrial killing in 4 years. And suddenly there were thousands of surplus airplanes and thousands of trained pilots. And the world was asking, what do we do with all of this now? The Daily Mail, the big London newspaper, had an answer. They'd actually posted it back in 1913 before the war started, a prize of 10,000 British pounds for the first aviator or aviators to fly nonstop across the Atlantic Ocean. That's roughly $1.5 million in today's money. The war put the competition on hold, but by early 1919 the prize was back on, and every serious aviator in the world wanted it. So you had teams from all over converging on Newfoundland. That was the logical departure point. Shortest great circle distance to the British Isles, prevailing westerlies at your back. Several groups set up shop in and around St. John's. There were the Americans with the Navy Curtis flying boats, the NC series, but they were doing it in stages with ships stationed across the ocean, so they didn't qualify for the Daily Mail prize. There were the Handley Page and Martinsey teams trying to assemble their big machines in time. And then there was Harry Hawker. Harry Hawker was Australian. Born in 1889 in Melbourne, he'd gone to England as a young man, got a job at Sopwith Aviation, and within a few years he was their chief test pilot and one of the most famous aviators in the British Empire. He was 30 years old, fearless and absolutely determined to be the first man across the Atlantic. His navigator was Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Mackenzie Grieve of the Royal Navy, a serious, methodical man, exactly the kind of person you want next to you when you're trying to find Ireland from 1,500 miles away with nothing but a sextant and dead reckoning. Their airplane was a modified Sopwith biplane, purpose-built for the crossing. They called it the Atlantic. It was powered by a single Rolls-Royce Eagle engine, a 360-horsepower inline-six, a good engine, reliable by the standards of the day. But they only had one of them, one engine to carry two men across 1,400 nautical miles of the coldest, most unforgiving ocean on the planet. Now here's where it gets interesting. The airplane had a clever feature. The undercarriage, the landing gear, was designed to be jettisoned after takeoff. You drop the wheels into the sea to reduce drag and weight. The idea was that when they got to Ireland, they'd belly land on the fuselage, which had a boat-shaped hull. Smart thinking for range. Terrible thinking if you needed to come back. The moment those wheels hit the water off Newfoundland, there was no turning around. They took off from a small field near Mount Pearl, just outside St. John's, on the afternoon of May 18, 1919. Late afternoon, around 5:45 local time, Hawker wanted to time it so they'd arrive over Ireland in daylight. The weather was not great. Heavy overcast, fog banks on the horizon. But they'd been waiting for weeks, watching the other teams getting closer to ready, and Hawker was not a patient man. He wanted to go. The Atlantic climbed out over the Newfoundland coast, Mackenzie Grieve got his initial fix, and they headed east into the gathering dusk. Below them, the gray Atlantic, above them thickening cloud, behind them the last solid ground they'd see for a very long time. For the first several hours, things went reasonably well. The Eagle engine hummed along. Mackenzie Grieve got star sights when gaps in the clouds allowed it. They climbed and descended through layers of cloud and rain, trying to find smooth air and favorable winds. The open cockpit meant they were exposed to everything. The cold, the rain, the slipstream battering them at over 90 miles an hour. Somewhere around the halfway point, around 1 in the morning, everything started going wrong. Hawker noticed the engine temperature climbing. The water circulation system, which cooled the Rolls-Royce, was clogging. Sediment or debris in the water was blocking the flow. Now in an airplane with one engine over the middle of the North Atlantic at night, a rising temperature gauge is about the worst thing you can see, because you know exactly what happens next. The engine overheats, it seizes, and you're a glider. A very heavy, very un-aerodynamic glider, a long way from anywhere. Hawker tried everything. he climbed to colder altitudes hoping the frigid air would help cool the engine externally. 13,000 feet, 14,000. He and Mackenzie Greve were gasping in the thin, freezing air with no oxygen. The temperature gauge would drop a little, then start climbing again. He'd descend to warmer, thicker air, and the engine would run hotter. They were fighting a losing battle, and they both knew it. The question was no longer whether they would make Ireland. The question was whether they could find a ship. Mackenzie Greve worked the navigation. Hawker nursed the engine. They had studied the shipping lanes before departure and knew roughly where the transatlantic steamer tracks ran, if they could get close to a shipping lane and ditch while the engine was still running. While they still had some control, they had a chance. If the engine quit at the wrong moment, in the dark, in heavy seas, they probably wouldn't survive the impact. As dawn broke on May 19th, they were descending through cloud, the engine temperature pegged dangerously high, and Hawker was looking for a ship, any ship. And then through a break in the overcast, they spotted her. A small Danish tramp steamer called the Mary, just a little cargo vessel plodding along her route.
Hawker brought the Sopwith Atlantic down. Imagine this from the deck of the Mary. You're a Danish sailor in the middle of the North Atlantic, and out of the fog drops a biplane with no wheels, engine coughing, heading straight for the water beside your ship. Hawker put her down in the swells. The boat-shaped hull did its job. The airplane stayed afloat long enough for both men to climb out and be hauled aboard the Mary by her astonished crew. They were soaked, freezing, exhausted, but alive. Now here's the part of the story that gives me chills every time. The Mary had no wireless, no radio transmitter. She was a small cargo vessel, and in 1919, not every ship had radio equipment. So Hawker and Mackenzie Greve were rescued sitting in a warm cabin drinking Danish coffee, and the entire world thought they were dead. Days passed. No word from the Atlantic. No sighting. No wreckage. Nothing. The newspapers that had breathlessly covered the departure now ran headlines presuming the worst. King George V sent a personal message of condolence to Hawker's wife, Muriel. The aviation community mourned. Two more good men lost to the Atlantic. Almost a week went by. 6 days of silence. Then the Mary made port at Butt of Lewis, the northernmost tip of Scotland's Outer Hebrides. And off walked Harry Hawker and Kenneth Mackenzie Greve, very much alive, a little sheepish, and immediately famous in a way that even their departure hadn't made them. The relief was extraordinary. London erupted. King George, who must have felt rather awkward about those condolence letters, instead awarded both men the Air Force Cross. The Daily Mail, even though Hawker and Mackenzie Greve had not completed the crossing, awarded them a consolation prize of £5,000, half the full prize. Because the editors recognized what everyone recognized. These two men had tried something insanely brave, nearly died doing it, and conducted themselves with absolute professionalism the entire way. The Sopwith Atlantic herself sank. The Mary's crew tried to salvage her, even got a line on her, but she was waterlogged and went down. She's still out there somewhere on the floor of the North Atlantic. A few weeks later, on June 14th and 15th, John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown made it all the way across in a modified Vickers Vimy and claimed the Daily Mail Prize. And that's the flight that ended up in the history books, rightly so. They earned it. But Hawker and Mackenzie Greve's attempt matters. It matters because it showed the world that the Atlantic could be challenged with the technology of the day. It proved that navigation across open ocean was feasible with a skilled navigator working star sights and dead reckoning. It demonstrated that even when the machine fails, the crew can survive if they keep their heads and work the problem. Those 6 days of silence, when everyone assumed they were dead, made the public understand the stakes in a way that no pre-flight press conference ever could. And Harry Hawker. What a life. And what a short one. He survived the Atlantic only to die 2 years later, in July of 1921, when a Newport Goshawk he was testing for the aerial derby crashed near Hendon Aerodrome. He was 32 years old. The Hawker name lived on, though. His friend Harry Sigris continued the company, and Hawker Aircraft eventually produced the Hurricane, the Sea Fury, and the Harrier. Every time you see a Hawker Hurricane at an air show, you're looking at the legacy of the man who dropped his wheels into the Atlantic and pointed east. Mackenzie Greve went back to the Navy, served with distinction, and lived a much longer, quieter life. He rarely spoke publicly about the Atlantic attempt. Some men are like that. They do the extraordinary thing, then go back to work. That story draws on the archives of the Royal Aeronautical Society, Graham Wallace's account of the Atlantic Air Race, and the Sopwith Aviation Company records. If you want more like this, find us at radiohangar.com. Fly safe out there, and don't let anyone tell you a failed attempt isn't worth remembering.